Zach Ford is the LGBTQ editor for Think Progress, thinkprogress.org. He joins us today from Washington, D.C. Okay, Kansas and Oklahoma voted to allow adoption agencies to discriminate against same-sex couples. We're going back to pre-Obergefell, right?
Well, you know, what we've seen with same-sex marriage is the exact same thing that we've seen with abortion, which is they lost on the main point, and so they're looking for opportunities to chip away to make the right to marry for same-sex couples as small as possible, even if it still exists. And, you know, this year, we actually haven't seen quite as many anti-LGBTQ bills in state legislatures as we've seen in the past couple of years. Part of that is because Texas doesn't meet in even-numbered years, the legislature there, so we're missing out on some of the fun ideas that they might come up with. But the tactic that I think a lot of these states have focused in on is this idea of adoption agencies and other child care or child placement agencies being allowed to discriminate against same-sex couples. And so we saw within a matter of 24 hours, bills complete their voting in both the Kansas and Oklahoma state legislatures.
So where does it stand? It was passed in both legislatures, but it's not the law of the states yet.
Well, the Kansas governor promised to sign it. We haven't yet heard from the Oklahoma governor, but it seems likely. And they're not the first states to do this. I think it was South Dakota we saw last year. There's a couple other states that have similar laws. There's actually a lawsuit right now challenging Michigan's version of a similar provision, you know, a same-sex family saying we should not be prohibited from accessing services from these agencies that receive taxpayer funding just because we're a same-sex couple.
So just so we're clear here, they're not outlawing same-sex adoptions. They're saying that adoption agencies can exercise their religious freedom to deny same-sex couples an adoption.
Right, without endangering their state funding. That's like the important part, is that the state will continue to use taxpayer funding to subsidize adoption agencies that are going to narrow the pool of possible families to place these children with just because some of those families have same-sex couples.
Mm-hmm. And I was disappointed to read in Think Progress that the Catholics are opposed to gay adoption. Same-sex adoption. I didn't know that.
If anything, Catholic Charities in particular has been at the forefront of this fight since over a decade ago. You know, when Massachusetts became the first state to legalize same-sex marriage, Catholic Charities responded in turn a few years later. They had actually placed children with same-sex couples, but the bishops thought about it and said, this seems like we're endorsing this thing that we're bigoted against, so we're going to stop doing it. And what you'll often hear conservatives say is that Catholic Charities was, quote, forced to shut down. But what really happened was they decided to shut down rather than continue to serve and have to serve same-sex couples. So we saw the Catholic Charities in Massachusetts do this. They did the same thing in, I think it was 2010, when D.C. got same-sex marriage. They did it in Illinois. And what was, I think, the most telling example of this was when Colorado was considering civil unions about 5 or 6 years ago, Catholic Charities came and testified. And they said, we will stop our adoption services in the state if you pass the civil unions bill. Then there was a version of the civil unions bill that actually exempted them, and they still were against it. So the bill actually would have allowed them to continue discriminating, but they still said, if you pass this and recognize same-sex couples, just as a matter of principle, we're going to abandon these services. That bill ended up not passing, and then the following year, the Colorado legislature passed a civil unions bill that didn't have that exemption. Mm. And so, you know, their attempt to, you know, use this as leverage actually bit them in the butt.
Are you allowed to put a child up for adoption and say, I only want this kid to be adopted by a white couple or a Jewish couple? Are you allowed to specify? For example, I would think that Jewish people would say, I want my child raised by a Jewish couple. Are you allowed to do that?
I don't have a definitive legal answer that I can provide to that, but I think that's sort of the appeal that a lot of these agencies are trying to provide is, you know, we're an agency that has a Christian focus or whatever. And if you, you know, if you're a family looking to adopt and you work with us, we'll help cater that. And I think the same appeal goes for, you know, families that might be putting the child up for adoption. But of course, I think a preponderance of the children aren't necessarily, you know, being offered by their birth mother up for adoption, but a lot of them are already in foster care or have otherwise, you know, been orphaned. And we also know that there's a significant preponderance of them that are LGBTQ, way more than you would expect on just the basic, you know, percentages mm-hmm. of LGBTQ people. And it's because they've been rejected by families already. So you have these LGBTQ children who've already been rejected, put into the system, and now the system is going to favor putting them through agencies that already reject them, that will place them with parents that are more likely to reject them. So it's a whole, there's a whole lot of other stuff to think about that really contradicts the conservatives' claim that this will just allow more agencies to serve children. Because the reality is that they're actually narrowing the possibilities for serving those children.
Okay, you just threw a lot at me. There are LGBTQ children who are in foster homes.
Oh, yes. I mean, there's a statistic that hasn't been updated in a couple of years, but it was fairly robust as of 3 or 4 or 5 years ago, that 40% of all homeless youth are LGBTQ. So if we go with our normal assumption that, you know, about 5% or so of the whole population is LGBTQ.
I'm sorry, give me that number again. What percent is LGBTQ?
Five
percent is LGBTQ.
Is what our best estimates suggest. But 40% of all homeless youth are LGBTQ. So LGBTQ kids are 8 times more represented among homeless youth. So you have to think about the fact that that is factoring into what kind of children are in these services that need families. A lot of them are children that were rejected because they're queer.
All right, hang on. I didn't know this. So 40% of kids on the street are LGBTQ. What ages are we talking about?
I mean, the full range. You know, obviously, there aren't a lot of children who are understanding their sexuality before puberty. So we're talking mostly tweens and teens. But
And let's state the obvious, but I'll ask it. Why do they end up homeless?
Because they're not accepted at home for who they are. And if you're in a home that, you know, berates you or subjects you to conversion therapy or things like that, these are all traumatizing experiences. And you might actually be safer removing yourself from that situation than enduring it. And so between that or kids who are just blatantly kicked out, that's why we get that overrepresentation.
Let's stay with this for 1 second. So a LGBTQ teenager growing up in perhaps Kansas or Oklahoma reveals to his parents that they have LGBTQ, that they're LGBTQ. They're tortured by their parents. Right?
I mean, I don't want to say that all queer kids in Kansas are tortured by their parents, but, you know, if you're in a family that has some very strict religious beliefs, you might very well be subjected to different kinds of treatment to try to force certain behavior or force, you know, you to, you know, be ex-gay or anything like that.
When the state legislature in Kansas and Oklahoma and the governor of Kansas says he's going to sign the bill, when they pass a bill allowing adoption agencies to discriminate against same-sex couples, what they're doing is they're telling a father and a mother that if they have an LGBTQ teenager, there's something wrong with their kid. They're almost giving license to torture their children.
Well, and that's why I and a lot of other LGBTQ activists frame these kinds of laws as a, quote, license to discriminate. Because even though it's not mandating discrimination, it's not only promising that if an organization discriminates, they'll be okay. It's almost sort of encouraging, right? It's mm-hmm. green lighting that kind of discrimination.
Right. Wow. So 40% of the kids on the street are LGBTQ. They end up, hopefully, in a foster home. Are they better off? Well, statistically, are they better off being adopted by a same-sex couple? I would think yes.
I mean, I don't know that we're at a point where we have that kind of data, but I agree with you that it's a pretty obvious, you know, thing that, like, a couple who themselves are comfortable with their own sexuality are probably going to be a more welcoming home for an LGBTQ kid than you know, someone who's intentionally using a Christian-affiliated adoption agency to cater to their conservative religious beliefs.
Let's go back to 2004. We talked about this, I think, 3 weeks ago when George W. Bush and Karl Rove ran the most homophobic presidential campaign in American history. Same-sex marriage, I believe it was same-sex marriage, was on the ballot in several states.
Mm-hmm. Over a dozen.
Yeah. And so what happened is that encouraged Republicans to come to the polls on election day to persecute LGBTQ community and stay to vote for George W. Bush. One of the things I remember thinking and saying was, why aren't the Republicans going after same-sex adoptions first? Wouldn't that be a more politically incendiary issue than same-sex marriage? I would think that if you want to animate your conservative base, same-sex adoption would be the issue.
Well, I think that's what we're seeing now. But yeah. I think that the reason that maybe that didn't happen is what I usually call a squares and rectangles kind of thing, which is, you know, if a couple can't marry, in a lot of states, they can't adopt either. And so it was easy. It was almost sort of like by opposing marriage, they were also opposing adoption, whereas by only opposing adoption, they might be leaving room for marriage without adoption. So mm-hmm. I think it was more that marriage was the first, more important gate to hold against equality. And adoption was, you know, kind of baked into that already.
Okay. Before we move on, these state legislatures are passing laws that are allowing adoption agencies to forbid same-sex couples from adopting children. That's going to have to go to the Supreme Court, right?
Well, we'll see how it goes. I mean, it's still true that you can adopt if you're a same-sex couple in one of these states. So it has to really be about, you know, this funding and is it considered, you know, establishment of religion and things like that.
It's like the baker not wanting to make the cake for the same-sex wedding, right?
A little bit. In that case, Colorado has a law preventing that kind of discrimination, and that law was enforced appropriately, and the baker's just fighting it. Right. In these cases, it's the opposite, where the state's saying, hey, go ahead and discriminate, and it's same-sex couples saying, by allowing that discrimination and subsidizing it with taxpayer funding, you're violating our rights. So it's a slightly different legal question for them to consider. But like I said, there's this lawsuit in Michigan, which is the first one challenging this kind of law. And we'll just have to see where that goes.
Let's move on to anti-LGBTQ groups freaking out, you write, after Amazon blocked it from using their donation system to raise money. I'm against monopolies. But one of the things I'm finding in the past couple of years is a lot of the banks and a lot of companies like Amazon are doing what the government can't when it comes to social issues and gun issues. A lot of banks now are refusing to process credit cards that come from gun shows, and a lot of banks are refusing, like PayPal is refusing to do business with any group that's listed as a terrorist organization by the Southern Poverty Law Center. And now Amazon is, I guess you write, standing up for LGBTQ rights. What happened with Amazon?
Sure. Well, it's important to note that nothing new happened, and a lot of this is theater. But the Alliance Defending Freedom, which is now one of the biggest, you know, Christian conservative legal groups in the country, they actually wrote the bills that we were just talking about in Oklahoma and Kansas, and they're fighting LGBTQ equality in plenty of other places, and they're also representing the Baker in the Supreme Court case. They noticed that they were no longer eligible for Amazon's Smile program, which is when you make a purchase through Amazon, you can direct a small percentage of your purchase to a charity. And Amazon's reason for this was that they looked at the Southern Poverty Law Center's list of hate groups and considered them ineligible. And the reason this isn't new is because Family Research Council made a huff about the same thing 2 years ago. It just so happened that Alliance Defending Freedom hadn't been updated on the list yet. And so it's a new thing for them that they're not getting these donations. But I think you and I have talked about this before, that there's this really epic campaign among these groups to try to delegitimize the Southern Poverty Law Center and distance themselves from this hate group label. But when they do that, they never actually take any accountability for all of the thoughtful reasons that they've received that label from the SPLC in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does give a lot of power to the Southern Poverty Law Center if you get labeled a racist or a hate group by them. You're screwed, but I don't have a problem with the Southern Poverty Law Center. My mother does, because they won't leave her alone. They keep asking her for money. But you have no problem with the Southern Poverty Law Center. Has anybody been able to show them corrupt?
You know, there have been a lot of attempts to. I haven't really found any of those compelling. I think, you know, they have such an epic track record of fighting for civil rights, and they continue to. You know, there was this case of the ex-gay therapy clinic in New Jersey that they successfully sued. I think we talked about that a little bit recently even. I think that there are sometimes disputes about individuals that they have counted as, you know, supporting Islamophobia and things like that. But their track record is very strong, and their criteria is fairly robust. So whenever one of these groups gets added to their hate group list, they have, you know, extensive research documenting all of the reasons that they made that, you know, drew that conclusion. And for the Alliance Defending Freedom, that includes, repeatedly defending and arguing for criminalizing homosexuality, and not to mention all of the junk science that they promote to justify rejecting LGBTQ people. So what's interesting is all of these attempts to delegitimize the SPLC are kind of a show to distract from the real criteria that the SPLC is using to point out, like, hey, you guys are terrible, awful people who are causing a lot of harm to a lot of individuals, and that's what we're trying to call out.
Let's go to the National Review. Bill Buckley is the father of American conservatism. He passed away about 10 years ago. The National Review has some interesting writers. It's been eclipsed by the Weekly Standard, which is more of a neocon rag that Bill Kristol founded. I would say the National Review is where you'll find the paleoconservatives, the more traditional Barry Goldwater conservatives. There were rumors, and you don't have to dignify this, but there were always rumors about Bill Buckley's sexuality. Now the National Review is asking whether or not we should accept trans people. And it's created quite a dust up. I noticed that Eric Erickson refers to transgender people as mentally ill, as opposed to being transgender, that he sees as a mental health issue. What's going on over at the National Review?
Sure. This is quite the interesting little kerfuffle. Somebody at the National Review, a guy by the name of J.J. McCullough, wrote an op-ed on Wednesday saying, you know, I think we should reach this compromise on trans people where we'll acknowledge that they're human so long as progressives, aren't so authoritarian and forcing us to respect them. And you know, I when I first read the compromise article that McCullough wrote, I was like, this is pretty dumb. He still justified, you know, religious persecution of trans people. He still justified policing trans kids' gender. And he still kind of suggested that he didn't really want non-discrimination laws to protect trans people from the kinds of discrimination that we know that they like from the Baker case. Mm-hmm. But it was still enough to even suggest that trans people are human that he got a whole backlash, including from two of his colleagues at National Review. So there's now three stories on National Review, his suggesting this totally weak and unconvincing compromise, and two people saying, no, no, we can't do that, including David French, who's been very outspoken against trans rights. And then a whole bunch of other conservatives have chimed in to just be like, no, 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 there is no room for compromise. So we saw Andrew Walker from the Southern Power, or from the Southern Baptist, got my Southerns mixed up there, the Southern Baptist Convention's Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission. He wrote a whole book justifying religious discrimination against trans people. And so he was upset about this. And we saw Rod Dreher, who also wrote a book about how Christians should separate themselves from society, what he calls the Benedict option, just so that they can avoid respecting LGBTQ people. Basically, everyone came out of the woodwork and was like, no, even calling trans people human and recognizing them for who they are is not okay with us. And so I just thought it was this really, I wrote about it, you know, on Thursday, yeah. Think Progress, but I just thought it was an interesting sort of look at, you know, the very little nugget of beginning to offer trans people respect was enough to trigger this sort of, you know, pissing match to see who can, you know, reject trans people the most. And, you know, I think there are a lot of times as progress moves forward that we see conservatives try to feign a little bit of compassion and try to offer, you know, we need to find a way to respect trans people while still justifying our discrimination against them. And I think this was just a wake-up call that those that feigned compassion should never really be heeded, that underneath it all is this total and utter rejection for their humanity.
Yeah. I bring this up because there was another piece, you didn't write it. It was in the New York Times. I think it was Barry Weiss or I forgot.
Oh, yeah.
Is it Barry Weiss? I
actually do not know how to say her name.
Okay. She wrote a piece about the intellectual dark web, and I found it very disturbing on many levels. One is because they seem to me to be alt-right intellectuals who kind of make things confusing and insist that what they just said they didn't just say, and they accuse people like me of putting words in their mouths when they're just trying to have a conversation.
Well, I'll go ahead and take that step and say that I never use the term alt-right. They're white nationalists. So
okay.
That's what they are, and they use the word alt-right to avoid taking responsibility for being white nationalists when much of what they promote includes that.
The one who I find really frightening is Dr. Jordan Peterson. He's a Canadian who is making a fortune now this past year speaking out against, well, not liberals. He doesn't really, I don't know. He does these linguistic gymnastics, and he's very slippery, but the message is it's okay to hate.
Yeah, that is an accurate reduction, I think.
And I guess he came to prominence because there's a gender pronoun dispute up in Canada. There's a law that says, I believe, and maybe you can explain this to me, I believe there's a human rights law in Canada that dictates how you're supposed to refer to transgender people. And Dr. Jordan Peterson, this Toronto-based psychologist, said he refused to obey this law because it's an infringement on his freedom of speech. Did I get any of that right?
Sure, but I it's just worth clarifying that this is something we're also starting to see as part of how gender identity, non-discrimination protections are enforced in the U.S. as well. So like New York City's Human Rights Commission also said that part of not discriminating against trans people is not intentionally and repeatedly misgendering them. So it's the same sort of workplace protection that, you know, if you have a black employee and you continually refer to them with the N-word or use it around them, they have a case of discrimination against you, right? You're creating a hostile workplace for them as a person of color. And so it's the same for trans people, that if you're continually rejecting who they are, I mean, it's not saying like if you slip up, you've committed a crime. It's if you're intentionally, repeatedly addressing them by the wrong pronouns and the wrong gender or the wrong name, you are being hostile to them for their gender identity. And it's just about protecting them against that.
Let's golden rule this for a second, because this is what's left out of the conversation. You have a person who's you have a transgender person who looks not similar to what you're used to. Is that a fair statement?
I mean, there's a whole range of ways that trans people might look, and I don't think it's appropriate for us to even talk about that. But I think you're right that there are some trans people who pass better than others. And so, you know, there might be a trans woman who can't undo the fact that she now has a lower voice because she went through a male puberty or some other male features like that. And so it's possible. But, you know, the other circumstance is when you have a coworker that you already know who has transitioned, and, you know, you might have a few slip ups, but the goal is that once they've transitioned, you respect them for who they are. And imagine a situation where you just don't, and that person is trying to, you know, find authenticity in their identity and constantly being rejected by the people around them.
Right. I want to simplify this and just bring it down to the golden rule. There is a person who you're working with who is transitioning to female. However, she still has masculine features. And the golden rule is you don't ask questions. You accept them wherever they are on the spectrum. And by saying to them, are you a he or a she, that is not respectful. Correct?
Well, I try to aim for the platinum rule, which is not treat people how you want to be treated. Treat people how they want to be treated.
Okay.
You know, there's another thing that my friend Vernon Wall, who's a social justice educator, says that always resonates with me, which is equality is when everyone has a pair of shoes, but equity is when everyone has a pair of shoes that fits. And so I think it's the same thing with thinking about the platinum rule, which is if you're not transgender, then how you want to be treated as a transgender person
isn't
a thing that you have.
Brilliant.
And so you have to think about how a person who is transgender wants to be treated. You can't just, you know, think it's the same on both sides, because it's not. It's a different experience, and the effect is different if you don't treat them that way.
Okay, so let's talk out this pronoun debate that people like Jordan Peterson, the psychologist from Toronto, refuses to address. The pronoun, the use of pronouns, makes it so you don't have to say to a transgender person, how should I refer to you? Is that a fair statement?
Well, I think what's at stake here is, and this is something that came up a lot in this National Review compromise debate too, is these people don't believe that trans people are real, right? They think that they're all mentally ill, as you alluded to Eric Erickson saying, and so they think that there's no legitimacy to being trans. And so from their point of view, to use a person's preferred pronoun is to recognize the legitimacy of their gender identity. And so what they're saying is, if you force me to use their proper pronouns, you're forcing me to accept that trans people are real, and we don't believe that. And so we consider this, you know, policing our speech. But like I said, it's the same thing that, you know, we wouldn't consider policing their speech if we said, you know, you can't go around calling gay people the F word in the workplace. You can't go around calling black people the N word. I mean, obviously there's different histories to all of these terms, but it's all about whether or not the environment is welcoming or hostile. And by repeatedly misgendering, they are acknowledging that their whole point is to reject the legitimacy of these people. And we also know that there are severe mental health consequences to that kind of rejection.
Okay, so how are we supposed to refer to transgender people?
However they tell us to. It's not hard.
But you know, your and they, isn't there a plural now that we're supposed to use? So that
it depends on the person. And this is why, you know, you'll see a lot of people in progressive organizations actually just putting their pronouns in their email signatures or things like that, or just making it a common practice when they introduce themselves. Hi, my name is Zach, and I go by he, him. And, you know, it's never a problem to ask a trans person what they use. They might use he, him, or she, her. They might prefer they, just as sort of an ambiguous, you know, pronoun. And because we actually use they in language a lot when we don't know mm-hmm. the gender of a person that we're talking about. And then there are a couple of other gender neutral pronouns that some trans people and non-binary people have adopted. And, you know, if you don't know them, that's okay, but you can learn them and you can learn to use them. It's not a complicated thing figure out how to respect a person, even if it's a new concept.
Okay, so you have a coworker who's a transgender person. He, him, they don't tell you what pronoun to use. What do you do? Do you ask them? But by asking, you're kind of drawing attention to it, right?
I mean, it's not, I don't think so, because asking is about recognizing, I want to do right by you. Please let me know how to do that so that I'm not doing wrong by you. It's not, you know, it's...
Okay, so the uncomfortable situation is if you say to a transgender person, I'm not quite sure if, you know, where you are, is that an insult?
Well, if you frame it like that, it might be. You know, it's a matter of, are you asking them to explain themselves to you, or are you asking them how you can best show respect to them? Because those are two different things, and they intersect. But if your goal is to show respect, you can just say, hey, do you mind? I just don't know what pronouns to use for you. Can you just let me know? And they'll say whatever, and then you use them, and that's the end of the conversation. If it's like, I can't tell if you're a woman or not, then, you know, that is a different framing that's going to put them on the defensive and make them feel like you're targeting them for who they are. So it's really about the approach.
Okay, my ex-wife really explained a lot of this to me through my hair transplants. I have hair transplants, and she said to me, it's how I feel when I look in the mirror. It doesn't matter what other people see. When I look in the mirror and I see hair on top of my head, I say to myself, I'm not bald. I have hair. And it doesn't. And that's kind of, that was a soft entry into the world of transgender people, my understanding what they see versus what I might see. So if somebody says to me, hey, I noticed you have hair transplants, you know, it's not the, obviously it's not the same thing. It does. There's a little part of me that says, oh, okay, I guess they're not as good as I thought they were. If you say to a transgender person, and I don't mean to be rude, but hey, I noticed that I notice you're not there yet. Or where you go. Isn't that a really difficult and rude question to put in front of us? How do you do that?
I think you are correct that it is a rude question to ask, you know, to try to comment on person. Because the thing is that they don't owe you an explanation for their transition, right? They don't owe you an explanation for how far along they may or may not be or anything like that.
But if they don't owe you an explanation, I know I sound like Dr. Jordan Peterson here. If they don't owe you an explanation, then do I owe them a pronoun?
Yes, because there's a difference in how you ask the question, right? You might be coming from a place where you are making observations about them, but you don't have to share with them that you're confused. All you need from them is, how do I show respect to you? And you just ask the question, what are your preferred pronouns? And then they tell you, and then you use them. You don't have to have a conversation about what you see from them or what, you know, or demand any sort of explanation of their identity. Just say, how do I show respect to you? What are your preferred pronouns? And that's a totally fair question. And it's one that, from my experience, a lot of people appreciate being asked, because it's just, you know, gives them the opportunity to make that clear clarification.
Okay. But you do see the I'm not trying to be difficult and disrespectful.
Oh, I see how rude your framing of the question is. I'm just telling you that you can ask the question without being rude.
Okay, and I'm just okay. I'll drop it after this, but I do mean this. I'm not, you know, we've talked about my playing the devil's advocate. I'm not playing the devil's advocate. I honestly mean this. If I say to somebody, how can I respect you? Aren't I running the danger of indicating to this person that they don't look the way they think they look?
Maybe, but that's one of the reasons that a lot of progressive groups are working to make it a norm so that it's not singling out trans persons. So I do this myself on occasion, that I'll say, hi, my name is Zach, and I go by he, him. I know I'm not trans, and I might not even be a space that has trans people in it, but by sort of norming that practice, it saves them from being singled out in that situation. But even still, there's nothing wrong with asking the person's pronouns, so long as it's your intention to then use them to respect them.
Okay.
But Jordan Peterson doesn't care, because he's got this idea of what trans people are, which is mentally ill, and he doesn't want to have to respect them in that way.
And it's just easier to say that they're mentally ill, even though he's a psychologist, and you've said that the DSM doesn't mean, the DSM says they're not mentally ill.
Right, and all of the major medical organizations agree.
So then, is it reckless and dangerous for a clinical psychologist to refer to transgender people as mentally ill?
Absolutely it is.
Shouldn't his license be revoked?
Well, I don't know about that because, you know, first of all, I don't know the extent to which he practices, because he's primarily a professor from my understanding. He might have some patients as well. I'm not sure, so I don't want to say one way or the other. But he also resides in Canada, so I don't know what their rules are for licensure and things like that. So that's an interesting argument, and it's not one that I can really comment on. But I think the bottom line is, how much attention are we giving him? How much room are we giving him to spout these ideas? And that's what I was so struck by, the biggest flaw in Barry Weiss's piece in the New York Times, is she suggested that it was this intellectual dark web, but a lot of the people she's talking about get lots of airtime, lots of places. So Jordan Peterson was one of them. Mm-hmm. She also talked about Ben Shapiro, whose site, The Daily Wire, you know, is one of the most trafficked sites on Facebook, and he's on Fox News every other morning or so. Like, you know, she suggested that these people with these like weird, dark, challenging ideas are in the far corners of the internet. No, they're everywhere, and they're getting lots of attention. And that's the biggest problem, is suggesting that, like, they're somehow being squeezed out. The reality is that they just have really vile ideas that hurt a lot of people, not just trans people, and they're being shunned for that. And the suggestion that they need more room is completely bogus.
Yeah. We have to wrap it up. And I'm going to return to the intellectual dark web with you, because I find it very disturbing. And I watched Jordan Peterson, and I realized I'm just a comedy writer. I could never argue with him. That's what I found very upsetting, that if I had him on the show, he would run circles around me. And
right, but not because his arguments are good, right? That's the important thing, is, like you said before, he's slippery. So he uses lots of, like, rhetorical jargon, lots of, you know, self-victimization techniques to claim that he's being attacked just for, you know, offering these ideas or whatnot. But he really has these terrible notions. And there's a reason that this, like, group of, you know, misogynist, white nationalist men have really clung to him, because he caters to that same notion that Trump did, that we're under attack because women have more equality, and people of color have more equality, and LGBTQ people have more equality, and who's there to support us? And it's really a dangerous line of thinking.
Before you go, and I'm asking for advice, because it seems like when I watch Jordan Peterson, I've been on some shows with conservatives, other people's shows, and they dance around the issues, and they use all these high and mighty words and theories, And I always get their hands to shake when I say, cards on the table, do you think LGBTQ marriages should be constitutional? Do you think LGBTQ couples should be allowed to adopt? Isn't that the best way to deal with these guys like Dr. Jordan Peterson, when you just say, this is the issue, yes or no? Isn't that the best way? Because I notice their hands shake and they get nervous and then violent when you ask them about a specific bill or issue. Then they can't really, then they're not so intellectual. Then they're verbally abusive.
I totally agree that calling the question like that is sort of an effective way to shut down a lot of the dancing around the rhetoric that they do. But I also think that the better way is to just not engage with them in the first place, right? They traffic in dog whistles. So they're looking for every opportunity to have a platform where they can say this sort of fluffy stuff that people who, agree with those sorts of biased positions, hear what they want to hear and feel reinforced in those biases. But then he doesn't have to personally take responsibility for holding those biased opinions when called to question. And so that's what it echoes the kind of free speech debate, quote unquote, on college campuses and things like that too, where we just know that these ideas are corrupt, right? Mm-hmm. These are ideas that do not have a solid foundation. These are ideas that are not supported by the facts. These are ideas that specifically dehumanize and delegitimize people's experiences. And yet we continue to, humor this idea that because they have an opinion, it deserves a platform.
Right.
And that's just not the case. And so the easiest way to shut a person down is to just not engage with them in the first place. They don't deserve that just because they have an opinion. If they're bringing opinions to the table that have an interesting foundation or that are worth considering, that's when we can debate them and call the question.
Yeah. And I got interested in these people before the intellectual dark web article was in the New York Times through some guests on my show, guys like Dave Cyrus and Michael Brooks. They like to, roll up their pants and wade through this muck. I never found these guys like Jordan Peterson worthy of my attention because, again, I think they're alt-right, provocateurs. They're they're like Milo Yiannopoulos. But do you have to pay attention to them? Aren't the Tucker Carlsons and the Laura Ingrams of the world, don't we have to watch them? Because aren't they creating the carbon dioxide that bubbles up to the surface?
I think we have to watch the impact that they're having, right? And so, like, Jordan Peterson, like I said, appeals to this specific group of men. And we now sort of understand this new term, incels, right? Mm-hmm. Involuntary celibate. People, these men who think that they deserve to have sex with beautiful women and are united by their shared anger that doesn't happen for them. And there was this case of the guy who, like, drove the van and, like,
Up in Canada.
And he was motivated in this act of violence by his notion that as a man who's not being handed out sex by beautiful women, he is a victim. And this is the kind of person and the kind of mind thought that Jordan Peterson's rhetoric appeals to. It reinforces that. And so I think we have to recognize what are these trends in terms of how masculinity has sent men down this path of feeling this way. And, even beyond the extreme of the incels, we've had a lot of conversations over the last decade just about the impacts of social media and the changes in family dynamics and the changes in the economy in terms of what do your social circles look like? Where do you get social support from? And there was a really interesting story on NPR's Hidden Brain about this sort of epidemic of loneliness among middle-aged men. Mm-hmm. And I'll be honest, like, I found things in that I related to myself, even though I think that I'm a pretty socially healthy person. And so there are all these dynamics in the world that people like Jordan Peterson prop up and reinforce. And I think the answer to that is figuring out how to address the root of that problem instead of spending lots of time spinning our wheels trying to treat symptoms like Jordan Peterson, who just kind of keeps this fueled.
You've been very generous with your time, as always. I have one final question to ask you.
Sure.
White men, white heterosexual men, are a problem in this country. And it's something we have to deal with. That we have a problem. We have a problem for a lot of people, but white heterosexual men are a problem. Aren't they?
Well, I'll say I think we have a problem when it comes to white heterosexual men, in that, yes, I think there's a lot of them that have some problematic, you know, points of view and are acting on them in some problematic ways. But I think, like I said, that's also a symptom of, we have to figure out how to better reach them and better support them. And it might not be a thing that we can handle with the current population. I think it's a thing that, you know, is impacted by generations. But how do we unpack these ideas of masculinity that gave them the idea that they could treat women, you know, fairly terribly and still expect to, you know, be rewarded for it, that then they are, you know, there's a backlash when they don't get that reward. Mm-hmm. I think we have to unpack all of these ideas of masculinity and the male dominated culture that we've had for ages, and recognize that some of that is changing, and we just haven't caught up with everybody yet, right? You know, if you're bitter because women have more opportunities in an equitable way, you're responding to entitlement that you feel because you have privilege as a man. And so we have to just help people understand that, like, equality means that you do have less opportunity, but it just means you have equal opportunity with everybody else. And that's not a reason for you to have a legitimate gripe with the world. That's a reality that you need to just accept and actually be happy about, that everyone else's opportunities have increased too. And we haven't done that education. We haven't found that way to unpack toxic masculinity so that they do understand that the world is getting better for more people, and there's a way that they can be a part of that, and instead of they're choosing to remove themselves from
right. But you just said something that I think leads to the cultural revanchism. I hate to sound like Buckley, but Trump, the success he's had is attributed to cultural revanchism. I don't know if I'm pronouncing revanchism. I don't even know if I'm using it properly. But revanchism is getting back your land, and that a lot of people, I hope it is, otherwise I'm a bigger fool than I thought, but that white men want, they've done studies, it's not economic threats, it's cultural threats that brought Trump into the Oval Office. And you just said something that I'm worried about, and that is equality means white men have to accept less. And I'm not so sure that's the way we tame toxic masculinity.
Oh, I mean, that's certainly not how I would help them understand it.
Yeah.
You know, we're speaking sort of objectively about it. But the reality is, right, if you're used to, you know, being favored, and
right,
now you're no longer being favored, like, you will perceive that as a loss. In the grand scheme of things, you are not disadvantaged, but you are perceiving a disadvantage from the point of view you used to have or that you were trained to expect. And so it's just helping people understand, you know, you don't deserve these things just because of who you are. And that's a good thing. And if we all work harder and all support each other more, society benefits.
Mm-hmm.
But we have to sort of undo that, you know, white privilege and male privilege and just sense of deservedness that is not true anymore, but that many of our current men grew up believing.
Yeah. We have a problem with white heterosexual men in this country. We do.
I agree.
And
I mean, and it's, you know, there are variations on that too, right? I know many conservative gay white men who feel very similarly and echo a lot of these principles too. So, you know, it's there are lots of intersections and there are lots of different ways that people are responding in this way. And, you know, we can even talk about the white women who voted in abundance for Trump in 2016. There's a lot of ways that this issue impacts people, and you can't just assume based on a person's identity that they feel one way or another, but it's just a systemic cultural issue that impacts us all in different ways that we have to unpack.
This feels like an issue Obama needs to address. I remember his speech, his famous speech after Jeremiah Wright, his famous race speech, where he says, mm-hmm. I can no more condemn Jeremiah Wright than I can my white grandmother, who would see two black men and walk on the other side of the street, and, you know, out of fear. That I think this is something we have to do. Anyway, I'm repeating this, but in a future conversation, there is a problem for white men, white heterosexual men in this country. And if we don't address it as progressives, I think we're going to have political problems in the future.
I agree.
Hey, as always, it's an honor to have you on this show. And I can't tell you the number of people who thank me for you. And I hope we can have you back next week. Zach Ford is the LGBTQ editor for Think Progress, thinkprogress.org. Read him and thinkprogress.org every day on the web. Can you stay on the line for 1 second?
Of course. Thanks for having me again,
David.
Thank you.